You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican, and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. The charismatic young black leader Fred Hampton was assassinated 50 years ago next month. We're going to be talking to his biographer, Jeff Haas, in just a moment. The Radio Cafe is brought to you by the Santa Fe Institute, a world-renowned research hub offering free online courses in the science of complex systems. Check out their community lecture series and summer science festival in Santa Fe. More at santafe.edu. I'd like to welcome back to the Radio Cafe, Jeff Haas. He's author of the book, The Assassination of Fred Hampton, How the FBI and the Chicago Police Murdered a Black Panther. And the date of that assassination, the 50th anniversary, is on December 4th of this year. Jeff will be speaking on Friday, November 22nd at 6 o'clock at Bookworks in Albuquerque, and will be joined by former Black Panther Aaron Dixon. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Nice to be here.
So, first of all, tell us about Fred Hampton. He was such a charismatic young man, gunned down in his prime, or before his prime. What was he, 20 or 21 years old?
21 years old.
And he had already made an incredible mark on so many people when he was killed.
Absolutely. I'm going to set the scene for you a little bit. It's Chicago, 1968, 69. You have a lot of things going on in the city. It's right after the Democratic Convention in 68, in which people are, of course, in the streets protesting the Vietnam War. The Panthers started in Chicago in 68, the Young Lords, a Puerto Rican organization, the Young Patriots, the anti-war movement. The headquarters of all the SDS branches were in Chicago. So it was very much a city sort of at play and very much attuned to the revolutionary fervor around the world, and particularly the protest movement around the Vietnam War. And so Fred was a young man whose parents grew up in Louisiana. Both of his parents were actually, their grandparents had been slaves, where they eventually ended up on the farms. They were part of the migration that came to the west side of Chicago in the 30s. And Fred grew up in the sort of working class suburbs of Chicago. He was originally organized in his high school. He actually led a walkout because black girls weren't considered for homecoming queens.
Right.
Also, there were very few black teachers and almost no black administrators at the school. And also, Fred led a march to the city saying, because there was no swimming pools, white kids could go to the next suburb where there was a private pool that they could go to. So Fred just had this sense of wanting to deal with injustice anywhere. He was also an amazing speaker, and he practiced listening to Malcolm X and Dr. King and knew the cadence of both of those folks. So early on, he was recognized by the NAACP, and he was made the head of the suburban NAACP in Chicago, which grew tenfold in the year that he was there. And then when the Panthers started in Chicago with basically some former SNCC people, they said, Fred, we want you to be our spokesperson. And
he was like 19.
He was 19 years old, and he looked it too.
Yeah.
But very refreshing. But he had a mannerism. He was absolutely charismatic, energetic, and he could speak to any groups of people, whether it was welfare mothers or black students or law students. And Fred just had that way about him that attracted people, that built coalitions, that started the breakfast program in Chicago, started a medical program, sold papers, and I think really raised the issue of bringing together a lot of the oppressed communities in Chicago, of course, particularly the black community. And so Fred rose to the leadership in Chicago, and he was even actually considered for leadership of the National Panther Party. And one of the things that happened was when Bobby Seale was bound and gagged in 1968 during the Conspiracy 7 trial because they wouldn't let him talk, Fred was outside speaking about Bobby. And, of course, the image of Bobby Seale bound and gagged went around the world because it was so similar to what slaves had endured. Anyways, Fred captured that energy. He also captured the notice of the local police so that he was harassed almost everywhere he went on all kinds of things. The march he led for a swimming pool in Maywood. Afterwards, some people got involved in breaking windows. He wasn't there, but they ended up charging him. And then they charged him for holding down an ice cream vendor and passing out ice cream to local kids. And he was convicted of doing that. And the very ambitious prosecutor, instead of getting, he had no record, you know, normally would have gotten probation, he gets sentenced to 2 to 5 years in the prisons of Illinois.
Had he done that?
He says he didn't do it. So he said it was, they got the ice cream vendor to identify him. It's unclear. But in any case, as he said, it's a Robin Hood crime. And he said, I might be big, but I can't eat 71 bars of ice cream. Was one of his jokes. Anyway, when Fred came back, we got him out of prison, our people's law office, which I was a young lawyer. He got out on appeal bond, and he came out and gave this really powerful speech that's been captured in the movie, The Murder of Fred Hampton. And he really moved people, and I was there, and my partner was there. And he basically said, I've been down to the valley, I've heard from the people down there, and now I'm back here, and we're going to listen to the beat of the people. And as a young spectator, I was in the audience, and Fred said, all right, I want everybody to stand up. And I did, hesitatingly. I was one of the few white people there. And he said, raise your hand, and I did. And he said, and speak after me. And I raised my hand, and he said, I am. And I said, I am. And he said, a revolutionary. And I couldn't say it. It just stuck in my mouth. But he kept repeating it, and the crowd kept repeating it. And by the time he was done, I guess I changed from being a lawyer for the movement to being part of the movement. And so part of that was representing the Panthers, the Young Lords. This was in August. And 3 months later, as his reputation grew both locally and nationally, I got a knock on my door one morning. It was December 4th of 1969, almost 50 years ago. And it was my law partner knocking on my door and said, Fred's been murdered. The police came in this morning and he was shot in his bed. And I was astounded because Fred seemed so vital, so life, he gave all of us strength, and somebody saying he was dead. So strangely, the police left the apartment where they had done a raid that morning. And Mark Clark and Fred were killed. But the police immediately went on TV and said, we were serving a search warrant and the Panthers opened fire on us. And we barely survived and we shot people because it was all self-defense, and put out this story about how many times the Panthers fired. Well, so my job that morning, or I went to visit, there were two people murdered, Fred and Mark Clark. Four people were shot and three people were beaten up and were in custody. So I went and interviewed Fred's fiance,
who was pregnant at the time.
Right. Deborah Johnson was 8 months pregnant with their child, sleeping in the bed next to him, and she was taken to the local lockup. And at first they wouldn't let me in, and then I read them the code, and so I finally got in to see her maybe 4 hours after the raid. And she was in a nightgown, and I didn't even, I knew who she was, she didn't know me. I said who I was with the People's Law Office, and of course she was crying. I said, how are you and the baby? And she said, I think the baby, they pushed me around and so forth, but I think the baby's okay. And I said, well, what happened? And she said, I was lying in the bed next to Fred, and there was all this shooting. The police came in shooting. They didn't announce who they were, and I tried to wake Fred up, and I shook him. And he partly woke up and raised his head and then put his head back down like he had been drugged or something, or was, it was with all the noise, it was totally crazy that he was asleep. And I said, and what happened? And she said, the police grabbed me and pulled me out in my nightgown. And then two cops went in the room, and she said, I heard one of them say, is he dead yet? And I heard two shots, and then the other one said, he's good and dead now.
You're listening to The Radio Cafe. We'll be back in just half a minute. Support for The Radio Cafe comes in part from the Lannan Foundation, presenting a reading and conversation by Nora Ericott with Janine Jackson on Wednesday, December 4th at 7 p.m. at the Lenzig Performing Arts Center. Nora Ericott is a human rights attorney whose book, Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine offers a new approach to understanding the Palestinian struggle for freedom told through the power and control of international law. Tickets available at the Lenzik or Lenzik.org or call 505-988-1234. One of the creepiest things in this whole book is the photograph of the cops who had shot him with this look of absolute joy on their faces with this young man's dead body.
Yeah. That particular photo, as I said, the police didn't keep control of it, but as they were carrying Fred's body out, a local reporter had heard about the raid on the... He was listening to the police radio. So he pulls up in his car as the police are carrying Fred's body out on a stretcher and catches those police smiling, knowing, of course, that Fred was dead, now knowing that they'd actually assassinated him. It wasn't an accident. And so what we got involved in was 13 years of litigation to prove what actually happened. And we started by bringing in an expert who we quickly established that all the bullets except one came from the direction of the police toward the Panthers. And that one came from a Panther who had already been mortally shot because it went up into the ceiling. So the police story that they were fired upon was not substantiated by the physical evidence. So even though they charged all the survivors with attempted murder, eventually they had to drop those charges. So we knew that Hanrahan was a very ambitious young man. He was going to be the heir to the original Richard Daley. And I think he thought that the raid would heighten his political career, particularly if he portrayed these cops as brave and so forth.
Now, tell us a little more who Hanrahan was.
Hanrahan was the young Irishman who grew up in the part of the city of the Irish community. And he'd gone to Harvard Law School, and he was the prosecutor. And he was the fair-haired Irish boy who was going to take Daley's place. And, of course, he had been U.S. attorney, then he was state's attorney, and then the next job was going to be mayor. So he had also waged this war on gangs. And he basically referred to young black people as animals, which kind of alienated him from the black community, but he was part of his current day kind of thing. He was, I guess, ahead of his day or behind his day, depending on which one you want to see. His father was actually part of a white gang that participated in the race riots in 1919, I learned last night. But anyway, so Hanrahan took on this thing, and we uncovered what actually happened. And one of the things the Panthers did is they took the community through the apartment. And they showed him the directions of the bullet. A bullet that enters a wall has a smaller entry point and a larger exit point. And so the community saw this, saw the raid, saw the bloody mattress where Fred was killed, and realized that this was not a shootout, but a shoot-in. And so we filed a lawsuit against the police, not knowing everything that we learned, but what we learned was that, in fact, the police were just sort of the last tag in this conspiracy, that Fred's murder had actually been set up by the FBI, that the FBI had a program called COINTELPRO, which targeted the entire black movement in particular. They had tried to blackmail Dr. King into giving up being a civil rights leader, claiming they had tapes of him in a sexual activity with other women, and Hoover did this directly.
J. Edgar Hoover, who had such an animosity toward the black community in America.
Yeah, he was frightened of any kind of black organizing. We actually asked one of the people in the FBI, well, what's a black nationalist movement? And they said, it's a black movement that has a national headquarters. This is the way they defined it. But in particular, part of their programs was to basically destroy the Black Panther Party by any means necessary. Destroy, disrupt, and neutralize the Panthers. And they had a particular line in their memo that was sent to all FBI agents, prevent the rise of a messiah who could unify and electrify the black masses.
And they thought that was Fred Hampton.
And that Fred Hampton was the person who fit that image, because in fact, that's what he did. So we learned through the lawsuit that a person who had been his bodyguard and who had been active in the party was actually an FBI informant, and that William O'Neill, the informant, had joined the party at the behest of the FBI. They actually had a criminal case hanging over, and he put himself in various positions. He actually tried to get the Panthers to do burglaries and robberies, create an electric chair to threaten supposed informants. I mean, he was really brilliant, but demonic in his own way.
Well, the kind of person that they used to divide a group of activists, essentially.
Yeah. Yes, he was. And he was very streetwise, and he was always very cool, and he was always saying he mixed with the criminal element and was always... And, of course, he had sort of immunity because the FBI didn't ever charge him with anything. But the other thing is that he was somewhat... He was almost a schizophrenic. What we learned was that 2 weeks before the raid, the FBI told O'Neill, we want a floor plan of the apartment where Fred and Deborah and the Panthers are staying. And O'Neill went, and he and his control agent, Roy Mitchell, produced a floor plan that showed the entire location of the apartment and where Fred Hampton would be sleeping. And in fact, when we traced the trajectory of the bullets, they went towards that bed. In fact, we learned it was a setup. And sure enough, the FBI, we learned, gave that floor plan to Hanrahan and the police. They went for the bait. They went in to do the FBI's dirty work. What followed was an incredible experience of us having a totally racist 80-year-old Alabama judge who wouldn't let us put on any evidence of the police misconduct and everything the Panthers had ever been accused of nationally.
And they didn't even give you discovery, which you were legally entitled to.
Right. The judge continued to say COINTELPRO had nothing to do with this case. And we had the documents because we were working with the church committee. They had turned over these documents. We said, Judge, what do you mean? That, you know, he was killed as a result of this program. Finally, during the trial, a lot of those documents came out, but in such an abbreviated form. Anyway, 18 months later, and the jury, and I was held in contempt because I tried to show the conspiracy between Hanrahan and the FBI. And the judge said, you can't go into that. And I said, Judge, you can't cover up the cover-up. And he says, you can go to jail. And I went to jail that night for speaking the truth. After 18 months, while the jury was deliberating, the judge dismissed the case. And what we had to do was win on an appeal. The case had been a gathering of evidence. So we went up and got him reversed. And they said there, in fact, was evidence of a conspiracy between the people. We said... They said our contempts were not contemptuous, that under the circumstances we were just being diligent lawyers. And also said that the FBI's cover-up of their own role could be introduced in a future trial as evidence of guilt. So what followed was negotiation, and we finally settled the case for $1.85 million for the families, which provided some monetary relief, but... As I said in the book, when I interviewed Iberia, Fred's mother, years later, she said they got away with murder. And in fact, they did. No cop ever did a day's time. Hanrahan, no one was ever convicted. And so we thought this was, I mean, the exposure of this FBI program, which targeted him, and we think maybe created the most well-documented case of a domestic political assassination, was really important. And I continued as a civil rights lawyer for 30 years in Chicago mostly, and moved to New Mexico and had enough time to write up our experiences in a book about who he was, why he was targeted, and this FBI program. And I try to write it sort of like as a memoir, as it came to me.
It's a memoir, but it's also like a courtroom drama. And to sort of walk with you step by step through all the things that happened, it's quite suspenseful. And it's also really infuriating. I mean, this judge who wasn't even following the law, and all the cops, and basically the huge conspiracy against the threat of this 21-year-old young man who basically was both idealistic and very smart. And I think it's important to talk about the Black Panthers because there's a lot of misconceptions that were sort of promulgated by the media about who they were, what they were doing, how dangerous they were or weren't. That was the context in which Fred Hampton came up. Talk about that.
Yeah, I do want to talk about that because, of course, the Panthers had appeared in Oakland and they had gone to the assembly with guns, which they were allowed to carry. Today, it's white people going demanding carry guns. But when the Panthers went in Oakland, they all got arrested and actually had to go to jail, even though what they was doing was legal. But the Panthers, yes, they did symbolize black resistance. But the Panthers had a very, their program was to connect with the community and to deal with the issues in the community. And the issues in the community were about breakfast program. The kids were going to school hungry. They didn't serve. This started the National Breakfast Program. It was health care. It was community control of police. And the Panthers made very strong socialist demands. We demand decent housing. We demand decent medical care. And things that they demanded that were seen so radical then, and, you know, by many, actually seem more in tune with what we're seeing today in a certain way.
Ironically, because those things are being denied to more and more people of all races.
Right. And so the demand for equal treatment, the demand for ending mass incarceration, ending police brutality, these were things that today have been picked up by the movement, the right to free health care as a right. But the Panthers were labeled as this violent group, as black men with guns, and of course played into the fear that, that white people had. But I think the fear of Fred was the fact that he could reach people, he could organize people, he could get people to realize that this system, they were powerless, and that they should be community control of these things. So I think it was his mouth, his ability to articulate ideas and convince people of them. Also, he really lived. People who knew Fred, you couldn't sit and be, you know, Fred said, if you're not willing to make a commitment at the age of 20 because you think it's too dangerous, then you're dead already. You
know, at the age of 20. At the,
you know, if you're too young to make a commitment, then you're dead already. And if you're not willing to struggle, then you don't deserve to win. And he really got people motivated. And I think that was the fear that the government had. So I really felt the importance of writing down his life. I think he had been objectified as both a Panther and why he was killed, but who was he? Who was this young man who was really a burgeoning leader in Chicago? And it was an interesting legacy because blacks and the liberal white community did come together to protest this and actually elected Harold Washington mayor a number of years later. But also I think gangs and drugs also, without black young black leadership, took over parts of the city, and I think still has that legacy. Anyway, I wanted to write the book as I experienced it, not like a lawyer arguing. So I went back and got a MFA from Bennington College, and this book was sort of my work in progress there. And I learned from some good people about writing memoir and making it interesting and make people experience what you experienced. And that's what I tried to do in the book. That came out 10 years later, pretty much on the 40th anniversary.
10 years ago.
10 years ago, 40 years after the incident. And so more recently, it seemed like both Fred's message, what the government did, and the need for radical change are even more clearer now than they even were. 10 years ago, Obama had just been elected. You assume it was 2009. People pretty much believed in this many people believed in neo-liberal ideas about things. We were going to solve the problems. Today, I think people are much more willing to accept the need for radical revolutionary change as we face climate change, as we face inequalities getting greater and greater, where the 1% or the half or tenth of 1% control more and more of the wealth, where the basics of healthcare, housing, education, not only are they being denied, but there's a movement that says these things are something that a society should provide, particularly the richest society in the world. So I think the traction of radical ideas is really, is catching on, is has more followers, more young people today don't believe this system as is going to solve our problems. I think that the term socialism, which for many years was unacceptable for any political candidate. Of course, Bernie put it out there in 2016, and now it's become, you know, everybody says there should be free colleges and healthcare should be a right, or a lot of candidates do. Those ideas are really acceptable. We shouldn't have this great wealth gap. And also the fact is that our corporations are threatening our survival, the survival of our species and all the species. And I think, of course, Trump has heightened those contradictions, and the fossil fuel polluters have been rewarded for, you know, for basically poisoning the earth or setting us on fire. And now it's like we're on fire and they're pouring gasoline on it. So we need a system that controls fossil fuels, absolutely.
And somebody might be thinking, what does that have to do with Fred Hampton? But you write in the new preface that his life really does point to a kind of systemic set of problems that were pointed out also by Dr. Martin Luther King, who talks about militarism and the economic system that we are living in and so on, and really brought those ideas together in the 1960s in a way that are more current than ever. And although I think some people don't necessarily resonate with the terms radical and revolutionary, it remains that what we're talking about is basic values.
I think that's true, and I'm just going to read a little bit from the preface. Fred's message is more prescient today than 10 years ago when the book was first published. The urgent need for revolutionary and systemic change has never been clearer. Fred Hampton and the Black Panther Party demanded and claimed as basic human rights land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, and peace, and called for an end to mass incarceration, police brutality, and the drafting of black people to fight in America's wars. The Panthers considered these demands fundamental rights and believed it was the duty of the government and society to assure them. Fred was under no illusion that the capitalist U.S. government would meet those needs, and he and the Panthers were educating the people to make the dramatic change necessary to assure these rights. They set up the breakfast program, the health clinic, and as examples of what a system responsive to people's needs would provide and what the current government did not. And Fred, very much like Dr. King, talked about militarism, the three evils of racism, materialism, and militarism. And Fred was, just like Dr. King, saw those inherent deep in U.S. society. And in fact, none of those things have done anything except in many ways gotten worse. Of course, we do see reactions to racism. We see the Black Lives Matter movement, many movements now, which are saying not only do we have to deal with the threats to all humans, but particularly around the issues of environmental justice, to the people who suffer the most under this system.
I think it's also important to talk about the context of nonviolence because, you know, Dr. King's movement going through the 50s and the 60s and the bus boycott and all the things that he did, and then he was assassinated, and so many leaders were assassinated in a row who held those values and who were leading those movements, both black and white, but especially Dr. King was. His assassination had the effect of causing some people to say, why are we doing nonviolence when they're so violent toward us?
Well, Fred Hampton, as you know, Dr. King's support changed when he went from the South to the North. Dr. King came to Chicago in 67, moved north, and said racism is not unique to the South. And he went to the west side of Chicago, and he went to Cicero and he said, I've never seen violence like this. And people threw rocks and bottles at him. And actually, Fred was marching in one of those marches for Dr. King. And he said, a white woman spit on this black woman next to him. And he said, I won't be nonviolent when the people against me are violent. And that debate between, and there's a movie that shows sort of Stokely and Dr. King debating violence and nonviolence in a march that they had in Mississippi. I think the issue is that they really were more and more in agreement on, though, was the need for fundamental change, that a militaristic society, an unequal society, not only created inequalities here, but now we know has led to more and more greater inequalities, and it actually threatens all of us right now. People can't ignore the fact that everybody knows climate change is a disaster, and yet our government is encouraging the fossil fuel industry, giving them subsidies, banning any kind of regulation on
withdrawing from Paris Climate Accords.
Withdrawing from, you know, removing limitations on coal ash. You know, it's sort of like they're in a hurry. You wonder sometimes if there's some diabolical desire by Trump and Bolsonaro to just play the biggest role they can in destroying the earth, you know, as though we can't stop it, so let's do it, you know. And it's not like they're really not, don't believe in climate change. That's kind of a hoax, you know. Trump says, I need more money for my golf course in Scotland because the oceans are rising, so I need a wall, you know. But
talk about, you know, hastening the apocalypse. And yet, there were then in the 60s and in every year since, and particularly now, all of these other movements toward really nothing fancy, basic equality, sharing the wealth, and having a clean, healthy, sustainable environment.
It's true. In the 60s, I think we, and certainly everyone, we felt like we were part of a worldwide movement where people were beginning to take over, and we were going to have a more democratic, more egalitarian societies, ones where governments guaranteed people the basic needs. And that had gone on in Cuba and Vietnam and much of Africa and much of Central, you know, South America. And now today, we're sort of fighting a counter-revolution, but also people, I think, are rising up because they see where this counter-revolution is taking us. So the demands, the simple demands for the basics that the government should provide and should provide equal opportunities for us, actually are coming to the fore again. I don't think people have confidence now that corporations are going to act in the interest of the people. Unregulated corporations aren't. So those demands, those equality demands, democracy demands, in many ways socialist demands of those periods, seem to us more urgent, more important right now as they get threatened. As you mentioned, now, you know, they're taking food stamps away from people. They're trying to take health care away from people. You know, all of this to benefit the corporations or the 1%. But there is a growing movement of young people who don't see how they're going to fit into the society that is being promised, you know, right now by corporate America.
I read this book when it came out and have been rereading it now and reading your new introduction to the book and thinking about how Fred Hampton would now be not even probably retired. He would be a man in his late 60s, early 70s, I guess, early 70s. And that leadership and that spirit was taken away from the Black community and taken away from the, you know, the whole community, the American community. You came up as a young lawyer. You were born and raised in Georgia and had seen racism and taken it in and weren't quite sure what to do, but hadn't really become active until Martin Luther King's assassination and then the police response. Tell us how you really entered this whole movement.
Well, I did. I grew up in sort of an upper middle class family in Atlanta. My parents were liberal in many ways. On the other hand, I grew up in a white community, and one of my earliest memories is the Atlanta Symphony would have programs for school kids. The white kids would go at 10 o'clock and the Black kids would go at 11. And I remember my mom taking me, and I sort of lived in a rural area, and the white kids were yelling at the Black kids just because they were going at a different time. And I remember interviewing Iberia Hampton, who grew up in Louisiana, and she said,
Fred's mother.
And she used to have to, school buses didn't take Black kids. So she'd have to go into town, because she lived 8 miles out, on Sunday night, and walk in. And the white kids on the school buses coming in on Monday morning would be yelling at them and throwing at them. And I realized she had been on the opposite end of me as a white kid, feeling embarrassed by what my white friends were doing, but not really confronting them. I think I said, you know, segregation sort of makes cowards of us all. You know, I wasn't the kid who said, I'm going to sit in the back of the bus, even though, you know, I knew that what was going on was really wrong. I think when I came to Chicago and saw what was going on, and the night Dr. King was killed and there was rioting on one part of town, I went and met a guy who turned out to be my law partner there defending. They had just picked up every Black kid on the street, no matter what they were doing, charged them with anything they could. And we were there, the only people trying to help them get out so they could go to school or go back to work or whatever it was. And that was just a slow process of from that point on, and then being in the middle of Chicago and the Vietnam War, and then the Panthers and everything. And I became radicalized. And as I said, that moment when Fred said, and, you know, I was going to live a really good middle-class life, and I still have in many ways, but, well, I'm going to be, that day job is going to be the movement, and my nighttime, I'm going to go back to the suburbs. And then Fred said, which side are you on? You know, are you a lawyer for the movement, or are you part of the movement? And I think that's been one of the lessons of my life. And it was partly through the remembrance of Fred that I ended up as a lawyer at Standing Rock and watching the tremendous protests and the water protectors and learning from the strength there. And Fred used to talk about the beat of the people and he listening to the beat of the people. And I felt like the beat of the people is here at Standing Rock. There's thousands of people who have put themselves on the line to protest this oil pipeline. And, of course, they were joined by everybody, including Fred's son, came up there, and all the other movements were.
Is Fred's son a chip off the old block?
In many ways, he is a spokesperson, and he's a rapper, and he does do commemorations every year on December 4th, and usually goes back to the address, which is now a gentrified neighborhood where the raid took place, and does remember, of course, what happened to Fred, and he goes with his mother, Deborah Johnson, who's now a Kua Nayeri, and they do commemorate the 50th. Oh, well, this year it'll be the 50th.
So one of the things that's a real difference between 50 years ago and now, I mean, one of the things that's so weird about this story is they didn't even seal the crime scene, if you want to call it that. I mean, it was a crime on the part of the police and the FBI. And there was a lot of, you know, sloppiness. I mean, the way COINTELPRO, this counterintelligence operation on the part of the FBI, was discovered was some people broke into the building, you know, and that couldn't happen today. There's so many more safeguards on government power and so many more sophisticated mechanisms that they use. But the same kinds of things are going on. I mean, are there equivalents, do you think, of COINTELPRO today?
Absolutely. Well, first, begin, as you said, their ability to gather intelligence, to do surveillance, to do wiretapping, to do, you know, monitor so much of what we do is so much greater. You know, they don't have to even have an informant necessarily because they can bug so many things or see much.
And they look at you through your camera on the device that you're holding.
Yeah, Israel has conveniently created something so they can monitor you everywhere you go. Apparently the Crown Prince used that to monitor Khashoggi where they killed him. But anyway, yeah, that's an example. And we saw other examples at Standing Rock of different methods of dealing with crowds, whether it was gas, whether it was these sound machines, whether it was mass armed, you know, people, riot police, whether it was tear gas grenades that they shot into crowds and or sound brigades. It means different methods of dispersing people, but also listening to people. And the other thing, I think one of the things that's new is private security now. You know, everything is getting privatized. And now it used to be the federal government or the local police. Now they have groups like Tiger Swan that were created in Iraq that come back and actually work with the police as a private entity. The pipelines can hire a private security firm that has their own intelligence, but they're not are really not accountable
yeah.
to the public.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think, and of course, one of the things FBI has labeled some people, particularly in Black Lives Matter, as black identity extremists, which has sort of taken the place of the terms, you know, black nationalist or black nationalist hate groups or whatever they would call the Panthers. So I think so. I think that the intelligence mechanisms, the criminal penalties that the oil companies are now trying to put in effect everywhere for people who would protest against pipelines, all of these things are making making it more difficult to organize, to do civil disobedience, and to increase the penalties on those who would challenge, you know, what's happening.
What are your hopes for Fred Hampton's story 50 years after his assassination, 10 years after the first release of this book, The Assassination of Fred Hampton?
Well, I think I would like people on the one hand to know who he was and for somehow his spirit and his indomitable strength to be carried on. And I think I end with saying, you know, as I said, Fred said, if you're not willing to make a commitment at the age of 20 because you're too young to die, I say you're dead already. And I say, if we're not willing to make a commitment in 2019, then we're all dead already. And I think Fred just stands up for the kind of spirit that we're seeing in a new movement, even in political people who are now willing to call out what's happening, who are now willing to challenge the idea that maybe billionaires shouldn't exist, and maybe we should have health care, and maybe there shouldn't be college debt. And things that were radical ideas that the Panthers put forth, I think people are realizing now more and more are what really is the only thing, the only opportunity or that we're going to have to save us. And not to mention, if we don't regulate fossil fuels, if we let corporations make all the decisions, we're not going to have a planet. And I'm thinking, you know, young people are very aware of this right now.
And I wonder if Fred Hampton would have been fighting for exactly that at this point, had he lived.
I think so. I think, you know, it's hard to imagine that he wouldn't deal with the issues that were most upfront and most affecting people. And so climate change, inequality, unjust wars, fighting over scarce resources, I think Fred would have been dealing with those things. And I think people who knew and were inspired by him, many of us are still dealing with those things and supporting the new movements that are arising that are trying to bring about that fundamental change.
The book is called The Assassination of Fred Hampton, How the FBI and the Chicago Police Murdered a Black Panther. Author Jeff Haas will be speaking on Friday, November 22nd at 6 o'clock at Bookworks in Albuquerque, and he will be joined by former Black Panther Aaron Dixon. There will be a discussion, and people can participate, and if you haven't seen it yet, pick up a copy of the book. Jeff, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much. And I did give the book when she spoke here to Michelle Alexander, and she wrote me 3 days later. She said, I couldn't put this book down. And she says, this tells us what's going to be happening here. It's a story that we all should know and understand how far the government will go.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And we'd like to thank our sponsors of the Radio Cafe, the Lannell Foundation, the Lannan Foundation, Lenzic Performing Arts Center, Southwest Care, and the Santa Fe Institute. Thanks so much for making this program possible. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lannell Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.